Blog Talk Radio.
I don't mind if you got something nice to say about me. I enjoy an accolade like the rest. And you could take my picture and hang it in a gallery of all the who's who's and so and so's that used to be the best at such and such. It wouldn't matter.
Professionals to help you leave your legacy.
Well, good morning. It is Tuesday, April 14th, and sorry for that intro being cut off there. We have this morning with us Les Ottolenghi, who is going to be talking about innovation. But before that, let me just run through our morning lineup. At 10:30, we are going to be receiving Ken Wybeck, who is going to be talking to us about leadership. And he is the executive director of a group here in Tampa called Life Work Leadership. And at 11 o'clock, Stacey Hunke, and she is going to be talking to us about growth. And she is an author of a book called Yes, I Can. And at 11:30, we are going to be joined by Pamela Skillings, who is my partner in the 11:30 show called Corporate Escape Artists. And Pamela is the author of a book called Escape from Corporate America. Well, Les, what's the weather like in Atlanta this morning?
Oh, boy. We're still getting through the trees and the rain and all the other things that came through on Monday, but hopefully we're going to get some sun tomorrow. The big problem was 200,000 people without power.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's always amazed me here in Tampa that we don't actually go through that when we have storms. And today is one of the 30 days of rain that we get a year that the Tampa Chamber of Commerce doesn't like to talk about. But I woke up to thundering, very 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 loud thunder over our roof. But we've had just barely a flicker of the lights. So
a little bit easier than Atlanta.
Well, hey, I am so glad that you could join me today. And the subject of our first show this morning is innovation. And when I thought about who I should have on the show, you have always been one of the most innovative people that I knew. And we got to know each other actually quite a long time ago, back in the mid-90s, when you were working for the Holiday Inn Corporation. So why don't you tell me just a little bit about what you did there and what innovations that you were a part of?
Sure, absolutely, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show this morning. The topic of innovation is really close to me and dear to my heart. As you just said, Chickie, I've been working on innovation since the mid-90s and even before that, when I had graduated from college, starting my own software company. But from the point forward of where we know the internet as an innovative platform or innovation platform, I have been working on different projects that put applications and companies on the internet and give them a strategic advantage. So back in the mid-90s, I started working with Holiday Inn Worldwide. And literally 1 month into the job, and this is 1994, so July of 1994, I proposed to my bosses, the CIO and the president of Holiday Inn Worldwide, that I would put them on the internet. Well, in 1994, nobody had heard of the internet, much less had an idea that you could do something like a travel reservation on the internet. And so I ended up... And one afternoon, convincing those two executives plus the rest of the executive management team that going on the internet was a great thing, and literally did this by running a telephone cord down two flights of stairs in the massive headquarters of Holiday Inn through the little fire escape areas and then into a conference room and showing them how to get on the internet. So we launched in November of 1994 the very first travel reservation system on the internet, and the whole experience took off for Holiday Inn as well as for my career.
Well, that's really interesting. And then, as I understand it, you were recruited to Minneapolis, although you did stay in Atlanta, to work with Carlson Companies. And the thing that stuck out to me, again, you know, you're right, people weren't really aware of the internet. And by the time you ended up at Carlson, I think people were starting to understand it, but still really only as a brochure-ware kind of tool. And you went to Carlson and you came up with a term that has stuck with me forever. In fact, I still use it today to try to help investors understand what's going on in the travel industry, and that was Click, Walk, Talk.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that project.
Absolutely. The Carlson Companies, which is Carlson Bag and Lee Travel, Radisson Hotels, TGI Fridays, and several other major brands, had recruited me for their travel leisure division. And I came in as the CIO with the idea that we would transform Carlson's present business systems into web-based systems to service the travel leisure customer. So anybody who wanted to walk into a travel agency or telephone, or for that matter, now get on the internet. So Click, Walk, and Talk was born, and it stuck as a way to understand and clarify the meaning and power of an innovation platform like the internet. One of the things, though, that wasn't apparent and that I've always found is a struggle for people is if you cannot bring it down to a clear term like Click, Walk, and Talk, they don't necessarily get what an innovation platform is. They usually end
right.
up focusing on the technology, per se. And so with Carlson, what we did was we put this term Click, Walk, and Talk in people's minds so they understood, okay, our business is now about people walking in, talking to us, but also clicking and merging that. And we were able to move the travel agencies, which did not have any type of consumer-facing system to a completely web-based platform that allowed for a customer to have their own personal record show up on the screen of an individual travel agent and at the same time be able to surf to the internet and look for specials or do a booking or do the types of things that fast forward now 13, 14 years people are doing and considering normal behavior.
Right. And what kind of barriers did you run into both at Holiday and at Carlson? I mean, you mentioned people seeing it just as a technology initiative instead of seeing it as really transforming the way that they interacted with their customers. Were there other barriers that you had to overcome during that time?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the cultural types of questions that you just brought up. Having them understand and comprehend the value to their business and how transforming their business with an innovation platform can give them a competitive advantage and a strategic advantage. So in an immediate term, they can see a return, so the competitive advantage, and then a strategic advantage which sustains that long-term competitive advantage. In other words, makes them competitive for a long time. And the biggest challenges were to educate people on what's going on in technology and how this would apply to their business, and then not only educate them but create models for return, so financial models as well as value in the presence in the mind of the consumer to the brand. So really the basic things like can we make more money or save more money by using these technologies or innovation platforms, and as a result, can we also increase mind share and value in the perception of the customer with our business.
Right, right. Now, it's interesting, Les, and you know, I've done a lot of work with Carlson as well, and there are some very, very bright people there. But, you know, as the internet really got traction in the late 90s and early 2000 timeframe, and, you know, sites like Travelocity and Expedia had really moved to the forefront, and Priceline had come on the scene and in early 2000 timeframe orbits. American Express and Carlson were conspicuously absent on the consumer side of things. And, you know, it really is very interesting to me even now that they remain the number one and number two travel companies worldwide, but very, very close on their heels now. I believe Expedia is in the number three position. And you know, matched against the physical infrastructure and the brick-and-mortar infrastructure of those two companies. You know, what do you think caused that to happen, and how did they miss it?
Well, again, I think this comes down to culture. A lot of organizations that are very secure in a certain way of doing business and making money, when they see innovation, they don't understand that they can adopt it, and then they can adapt it to their business and allow them to continue to make money the way at the rate that they were in the past. The biggest problems for American Express and for Carlson have been this ability to give away a bit of the revenue that they expected every quarter and every year for a short period of time in order to invest on the new way of doing business.
Right.
I think if you were to put them in a little time machine, knowing what they know now, and they were to go back, they would invest heavily in this and realize that they may have to forfeit some of their present business process and operations and business line. The popular term is cannibalize some of their business in
right.
order to go to the future, sacrifice what they have today for the future. And, it's clear that online travel agencies like Expedia, Travelocity, and Orbitz have come up close behind them. And now, in a matter of years, if not, shorter, they will overtake both those true and tried brands.
Yeah, I think, it's interesting when we look across other industries. And, what was happening kind of in the background at the time that those agencies were coming to the forefront, you had travel suppliers who were also rapidly trying to mirror what you had accomplished at Holiday Inn, and both on the hospitality side and on the airline side. And, I would say that the airlines have probably been the leader on the supplier side of getting on the Internet and selling their product. But you made an interesting move then when you left Carlson, and you and a partner ended up forming a firm that created a product that I'll never forget, sitting in your office in Atlanta and having Glenn, your partner, trying to describe this as you had created a face of a product so that the travel agent could see what it did, but what you had really created was the power behind the scenes. And he said this was like trying to figure out how to get a rocket out of a basement. And, I will never forget that day because of that. And, when we take a look at what you guys actually created, which we now know as MetaSearch, and what companies like Kayak and Sidestep and Mobissimo and others have commercialized, you guys were just way, way, way ahead of your time. So tell me a little bit about what made you become a corporate escape artist and leave the relative security. Actually, it was pretty strong security back then of being with a multi-billion dollar company, having a regular paycheck, having benefits, being in a family-owned company at Carlson, that really took pretty good care of its people. So what gave you that impetus to do that?
Well, I mean, I have I have three natural tendencies. One of them is to be ahead of the curve. End up thinking about stuff that other people start implementing a couple of years in the future. And melded with that is a fortunate characteristic of being impatient about seeing that future coming to fruition. So when I see a vision of it, an innovation, I think, gosh, it should be done, and it should be done right, and it should be done now. So I'm not too worried about, whether or not it has immediate applicability. I know it will have applicability. I just have to make certain that I time my own steps to be there at the right time. And then finally, I don't find security in cultures where they don't embrace innovation and see that change is coming. Because the pace of change has been sped up and will continue to accelerate. In fact, all evidence demonstrates this. Even our present economic climate shows that change can happen, and change can happen rapidly. You can have the fall of the stock market and wiping out an entire industry in literally a matter of months, whereas if you were to look at it historically, you could see during the Great Depression, this same sort of transition took 4 years. And it was obviously more severe, but it took at least 4 years for that same scenario to unfold and another 7-8 years for things to recover. we're not in those types of cycles anymore. So for me, the impatience of innovation and the natural tendency to try to gravitate towards seeing that vision come to fruition is actually security. I feel there's a lot more control and understanding of your own fate and making money and security in that than being tied to a situation or a culture which doesn't embrace that and is not willing to make the kinds of changes and invest against it. Again, right. I would say, you know, Time Machine would be in front of certain executives now, would probably allow them to make better decisions, and they would go forward with certain innovations, which would seem radical at their moment, but actually be in the best interest. So I got out of there because I believed it was in my best interest to do so.
Well, you know, it's interesting because then you went through the crash course of learning about the importance of hanging on to control of a company, what can happen when you've got venture capital folks that, you know, see what could be at the same time that corporate America still doesn't quite get the vision and the business doesn't move quite as fast as everyone would like, which, you know, again, is a pretty consistent characteristic of a company that is headed up by an inventor such as yourself.
Yep.
So tell us about that.
I think with outside, when you're trying to be an innovator and an entrepreneur and you're inventing new things and you're bringing them to market, the use of private capital in the form of, say, venture money also has a level of impatience itself. In other words, it wants to see returns pretty rapidly. So the flip side of this, in other words, it's just the opposite of being in corporate America, where you see there's too much time spent thinking about it and looking at it and not moving forward and having a certain trepidation in moving forward, whereas venture capital wants you to accelerate the process and get to the answer and start making money almost immediately. The reality is it's somewhere in between.
Right.
And so that lack of patience has to be balanced, since there is a level of control that investors, particularly venture capitalists, would like to acquire while you're building your company. And what I've learned the hard way several times is the manner in which you manage that. Now, fortunately, in my present venture, I don't have to worry about that because we're self-funded. We have some very large clients, and we're making money, and in these times, we're even growing. But that just speaks to knowing how to balance both the desire for innovation and doing something on your own and being an entrepreneur,
right,
and escaping from corporate America, and how to then grow the business without having a dependency on third parties for the capital.
Right, right. Well, I applaud you guys for what you're doing now, and you're doing some really amazing things, but I don't want to jump right to that yet. I want to. There was another interim step. And, you know, I would say that clearly under your leadership and with the amazing people that you surrounded yourself with, you know, from those times back at Holiday Inn to Carlson to your time at AgentWare, which was the company that we were just talking about that was really the inventor of MetaSearch, you know, you really, and I hesitate to say single-handedly because I know it never is a single person, but you drove forward innovation in an industry that has become a real leader, particularly in the online world. And then you set out to tackle what I would consider to be, well, certainly in most people's minds, the entertainment industry and the music industry were another major frontier in the electronic world. And, you know, here we had people who had relied on the sales of records and then 8-tracks and then cassettes and then CDs. And then along comes the internet as the great disruptor of that industry. And what got you involved in that industry? And tell us what you did with the company that you created after AgentWare.
Yeah, and that is a very, very good way to lay it out, because you know, AgentWare was a great MetaSearch company, and as you said, it allowed people to, particularly travel agents, to search all over the internet for the best fares possible for airlines and then ultimately hotel and car. And it became the leader in MetaSearch and spawned and inspired a lot of other companies to get into that marketplace. With the sale of agentware, I was prohibited from participating in the travel industry in any material way as an executive, an inventor, or a manager, or anything for 2 years. So I had a non-compete. And so I thought, gosh, what other industry is just as broken in terms of its business model for distribution as the travel industry?
Is that possible?
Is it possible, right? And I was actually taking some time off after the sale and was teaching at Emory University's business school, one class, and I had some students. And I said, gee, you know, I did a little survey. I went, what's your favorite thing to do online? And at that time, I had seen, you know, the Napster software, and I'm sure everyone had heard of it or played with it by the year 2003, excuse me. And so I asked the class, and they said, well, you know, we like to download music and then share it with our friends. That was their number one favorite thing to do online. And I thought, wow, you know, do you pay for that? And they said, no. And I said, gosh, that sounds like a good business to get into, something where the whole distribution is broken. The suppliers of the product want to get paid, but they're not getting paid, yet there is just a massive growing demand for services by the consumer to download their product, to download music, and to share it with each other.
Right.
So I created a company called Intent Media Works, and from 2003 through 2007, we grew the business to be the single largest distributor of independent music online, and then the largest distributor of licensed authorized content for music on the peer-to-peer or file-sharing networks. So as many of your listeners probably have seen or heard or maybe had their kids show them, there are these programs called LimeWire, and there was Kazaa, and FrostWire, and BitTorrent, and all these file-sharing software programs. We built a company that actually licensed music, licensed ultimately film and television shows, and we distributed them out through those networks on an authorized basis so that the producers of the content got paid. Very difficult, not easy for the distribution, but using technology and innovative thinking, just like in the travel industry, found out ways to put the content in front of the right people, the consumers, at the right time in enable them to get what they wanted and the people producing the content to get paid.
Well, my absolute favorite story during that period of your career, and it has just been so much fun watching you, Les. I mean, I live vicariously through you during those days. But you landed actually in the White House. And tell us about that story.
Yeah, I've got a ton of great stories. I've had people, you know, claim that I'm the Forrest Gump of entrepreneurs because I always tend to run across people in an odd way. But there was a Supreme Court case, MGM Grokster, that was coming up, and I had filed a brief with the Supreme Court about the authorized download of music through peer-to-peer networks and how that was possible. I'd also done some U.S. Senate testimony for John McCain's Commerce Committee, and then Federal Trade Commission, and so on. Anyway, I got a call one afternoon, and it was a person from the White House, the Director of Emerging Technologies, and she asked me if I would be interested in coming to the White House to talk about music downloads. And I said, oh, geez, that would be a tremendous honor. I would love to. You know, when do you need me there? And the back and forth and some phone calls, and finally, as it came out, I was supposed to go meet with the president. So I ended up in the White House giving a presentation in one of the briefing rooms there in the White House. And during the process, President Bush asked me if I could show him how to use and download music to his iPod. So I became the guy that showed the president of the United States how to download music to his iPod. Mostly country western and, you know, not a lot after 1990.
Well, that is such a priceless story. And, you know, as I said, I have watched you from afar. But during that time and actually as that venture was moving into its next life, as it were, with different investors coming in and you ending up moving out, I had the great pleasure of involving you in one of my entrepreneurial ventures, and while we're still waiting to see, you know, the outcome of that venture, you know, once again, we were way, way, way ahead of the curve. And kind of back, it reminds me so much of your experience back at Carlson of, you know, being ahead of your time, having all the right ideas, but not having people in a state of mind where they either really saw the need and saw that their old way of doing business, you know, just couldn't be sustained, and both from a business model perspective and from a technology perspective. So from all of your ventures, what advice would you give to me right now? We've got a company that's been sitting kind of on ice for nearly a year. We've got really innovative, groundbreaking technology that, you know, certainly by now we'll need a new face. But, you know, as I look out at, you know, do I get venture investment? Do I find a strategic partner? You know, what's the right way to go forward from all of your experience?
I think the question is, actually has to do with time.
Right.
And so the other, one of the many other Forrest Gumpish moments in my life was one of my roommates in college, we all lived in an apartment, was Melinda French, and she's become Melinda French Gates. So she's Bill Gates' wife. And so I was at their house one time, and I asked Bill, I said, listen, did you know that you were going to end up in this place, and you know, how did you know, and so on? And he goes, Wes, listen, it's all about timing. Yeah, I had no idea that we would become Microsoft. I had no grand plans we would become Microsoft. He goes, you know, we even had to beg, borrow, and buy some technology in order to even make this happen. So the truth of the matter is we had a vision, we had a belief, and we stuck it out long enough and for enough time that even if we were not meeting what the market needed, the market finally met what it needed. It met us.
Right.
And the two things got together and kept making history from there. And that always kind of stuck with me. Here's the richest guy in the world, considered probably the most successful entrepreneur of the second half of the 20th century. And clearly, he could not have predicted, forecasted, or planned his own success. And he gave me a book from his father who has written about, you know, success and accumulation of wealth and so on. And in the book, his father describes how his son never did all this on his own. It was not just luck, but it was the help of a lot of other very good people who believed in him. So it was timing and having the right people believe in you and helping sustain you through the times where the market may not see what your product is really and does not understand the value, but is ready and hungry for it and eventually accepts it once you persist long enough to keep your vision going. So getting more investors right now, that's possible, but probably a strategic investor, strategic partner who understands the vision, who sees the need for not just their present, but their future, who will not act to just to protect their own present turf, but realizes that their future is based upon the wonderful product you've created and the incredible vision that you've established. And that strategic partner is the best one to go get. Investment partners, they're looking for a quick return. But the Bill Gates paradigm, time and people who believe in you.
Right,
stick with those
right.
And you'll always succeed.
Well, you are indeed the Forrest Gump of innovation.
I am.
And I'm just waiting to see what color my chocolate is.
That's right. And that's the way it works.
Well, Les, I am honored to have you as my colleague, and it is just so wonderful to call you friend and to have watched your growth over the last, 15 years that I've known you. And, you know, I just wish you all the best in your current venture. In fact, I know I don't have to wish that for you. I've seen what you guys are creating at Fusebox, and we'll have to talk about that another day because we're running out of time. But I am just excited to see the next part of your career unfold, and I'm hoping that we can enjoy some of that success together.
We will, and I appreciate that very much. All your kind words. Thank you for your friendship as well as your encouragement over the years. We're going to keep going, right?
We are. We are. We're going to nail that big one.
Absolutely.
Okay,
Les. Thank you, Vicki, and I appreciate your time. Thank you to all your listeners.
Okay, take care. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, well, we are going to shift gears here, although it as always, is just another part of the story. We are going to move on to talk about leadership. I would like to thank our sponsor for today's show, the Executive Girlfriends Group, which is a group of women that share not only an electronic community, but share a relationship through a weekly phone call that the group has. And for those executive women who are looking for a place to form those kinds of relationships, we would love to hear from you. And you can reach the Executive Girlfriends Group at egg@solutionswithaz.com. All right. Well, we are going to turn to our next guest. Let me get him on the air. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I am doing just great. Now, tell me if I'm pronouncing your last name right. Is it Wiebeck?
Well, it's Wiebeck, but Wiebeck. I answered either. That's fine. It's a German. It's W-I-E, and it's pronounced Wiebeck.
Got it. Well, Ken, you know, I came across you, actually, as I had mentioned to you yesterday, through three or four different people in the space of a 10-day period who all told me that I needed to learn about the organization that you lead here in Tampa Bay. Now, this isn't just a Tampa organization, so I'm going to let you talk about LifeWork Leadership and how the organization itself evolved and how you came to be involved in LifeWork Leadership. And then I want to talk a little bit about what's different about the approach that you guys take.
All right. Very well. Well, it actually started about 17 years ago. It started in Orlando. It was a function of the Greater Orlando Leadership Foundation, and they went by their acronym. Greater Orlando Leadership Foundation was G-O-L-F. And for Orlando,
that played well in Orlando.
It does play well. And however, after about 15 years, they decided that they would actually follow the original plan, which was to take the program around the United States. They obviously could not take it to every community with GOLF as the acronym. So they changed the name to LifeWork Leadership. It very simply is a leadership program, which many people are probably familiar with, a 9-month program where people get together, there's a retreat, and then one class per month. And it's on leadership. But the unique aspect of this is that the entire curriculum is built around leadership that was modeled by Jesus Christ. As a historical figure, whether people have the Christian faith or not, it is understood that Jesus did walk the earth as a man, and he had a lot of things to say about leadership, and so our program is based on that. We have topics. Obviously, we start out with our retreat, and we talk about knowing God and worldviews and things, and then we go on to such things as relationships, integrity, compassion, humility, and then we end up at the end of the year, it's all built towards this legacy, leaving a legacy.
Well, very interesting. Well, what did you do before LifeWork Leadership, and how did you get involved?
Well, that's kind of interesting because when they really began 2 years ago to start spreading out, it started by moving down to Fort Lauderdale. And that was a result of a legacy of something called the Luis Palau Festivals, and they had Beach Fest
right
there. And Wayne Huizenga Jr., the name behind Huizenga Holdings and the Miami Dolphins and Blockbuster Video, he actually asked them to bring the program from Orlando down to Fort Lauderdale. And then at the end of their first year, they invited people from all over the United States, including some people from the Tampa Bay area, because we had just put a festival on here called Tampa Bay Festival with Luis Palau. It was in March
right,
of 2000.
I remember that.
Yeah, 2007. And so the leaders from the Palau Festival went over to Orlando. They looked at the program and said, let's bring it back to Tampa. We were looking for a legacy of of the festival, and we actually had two primary legacies. One was a group of people called Faith Tampa Bay, which does include a website. And when we put the festival on, one of the things we remembered from having gone through the Billy Graham crusade in 1998 is we didn't really maintain the connections from 1998, didn't have as much of a presence of the internet and all the various office programs that now you can keep a database. So when we put the festival on in 2007, Ed Coble, who is the president of DeBartolo Development, one of the things he said he wanted to do is make sure that after this festival was over in March of 2007, that there was something that continued, a legacy. And so this leadership program was one of the two things. And I was on the committee to help put the festival on, and I was blessed, really, almost by accident. I had actually called Ed Coble up, and I asked him if I could use him as a reference. I was going to be looking at getting back into the education field, which is where my most of my history was. And he said, well, if you want to do something in education, why don't you look into this LifeWork leadership? And before I knew it, I was involved as executive director. We had our first class in 2007 and 2008, and we're now into our third class, and coming up in May, we're going to have our legacy class. And interestingly enough, Wayne Huizenga Jr. is going to be with us May 5th. We're going to be holding the class at the University of Tampa in the boardroom at the Vaughn Center, and Wayne will be there along with Mr. Joe White from Men at the Cross, and we'll be talking about legacy.
I saw that, and I'm really excited to be able to participate as a guest that day, so thank you so much for inviting me. Tell me how you do your recruiting, or how people find you, and how you weed out the people who really should be a part of this.
Well, this is certainly just, again, as Jesus did with his leadership training, is relationship sales, if you will. We had a lot of people who were involved with the festival, obviously people who are of the Christian faith, leaders in the community, owners of companies or top-level executives, and we just reached out to them. They were familiar with some of the people connected with LifeWork Leadership, again, Wayne Huizenga Jr. and some of the people from Orlando. There were quite a few people from Orlando that have gone through the program, including executives from Walt Disney World and Epcot Center and Hilton Vacations and so on. And so we just reached out to people through the connections of friends, and they recommended the program, and people looked into it and said, you know, it's kind of interesting to actually have a leadership program where Christ is saying this is what leadership is all about, and he has an awful lot to say about leadership. He must have, because from 2,000 years ago, his leadership model has had hundreds of millions, billions of people connected with his leadership program.
Right, right. Now, one of the things I love from your brochure about the organization is you talk about the fact that the quality of leadership in an organization actually makes the difference between success and failure, and that those principles that you just talked about from 2,000 years ago about the leadership of Jesus are not only readily transferable for today's marketplace, but they bring principles that are both good for business as well as good for personal development. And so talk to me just a little bit about how the people who come into this program learn how to apply and how do you get from someone speaking once a month to actually integrating what they're learning into their companies. Is there some program in the ensuing weeks between the programs where these people interact, or is it really just these once-a-month meetings?
Well, there certainly is interaction, and the program, the class itself, which is one morning a month, this last year and this coming year, it'll be Tuesday morning from 7:30 until noon. First of all, the format of the class itself is designed to bring people to a conclusion about the applicability of the concepts. We want it to be something that they can readily use. We start out with, first of all, a foundation, a Jesus journey, if you will. What did Jesus have to say about a particular topic? And certainly from the Bible, we can see what he had to say about such things as relationships or integrity or something like that. Then we have a case study, and that's usually a local business person who has had a walk that included opportunities or challenges in their business life, in their personal life, in which they came to a point where they had to make some very hard decisions. And it doesn't always include people who've made the right decisions. We've had some speakers who have had some problems. A local person, actually Walt Pavlow, who has written a book, Stolen Without a Gun, and he shared with us the experience of working with MCI and having defrauded the company of over $6 million. And so, you know, the good and the bad experiences, and sharing with class members how you arrived at certain decisions. And, of course, Walt was happy to let people know that since the time that he spent in prison, the Lord has really gotten his attention, and he's moved in the Lord's direction. But most of the other business people will share opportunities that they've had that have been presented to them to make very important decisions, often very difficult decisions that may not have been popular with a lot of people. And yet, as they asked the Lord to show them how to make the right decision, they've often seen that those decisions, although not completely understood even when they're making them, always turned out to be the right decisions. And then finally, we have a national speaker, and we have a whole list of speakers that we can choose from. We've had speakers from Walmart, from Disney World. We've had the president of Disney World, Al Weiss.
Right.
We've had Gordon McDonald, Bill Pollard, who was the chairman and former CEO of ServiceMaster. And they'll come in, and they'll share their stories. And Oz Guinness we've had, for people who've possibly read The Call or many of Oz Guinness's books. And so, by the time we finish the class, we've had an opportunity to not only hear the stories of business people who've applied it, but then also from our speakers. And we have a question and answer period throughout the class, where people are able to ask the speaker, or in the case of a case study, the person who's presenting the case study, what did you do? How did you do it? How did you apply these things in your business? Sometimes it doesn't really present itself very clearly, but usually, and this is the great thing about the program, is that if people put it to prayer, the things they've learned, they'll usually find that the answer is pretty much a cut and dry kind of a thing. You go in faith that you've made the right decision. In between classes, people get together. We intentionally ask them to get together in smaller groups in between classes. They'll get together for a breakfast, a lunch, a coffee, or something
right,
like that, and continue to work on things. The idea, Chickie, is that there's going to be a transformation. God doesn't leave people exactly where they are. He loves them where he found them, but he wants to move them along. And as people begin to really study the curriculum, read books, and discuss things, they start moving in the direction of feeling confident in their decisions, and then they share this in between classes as well.
Have you seen any situations where people have come in with a business that perhaps is failing, and that, you know, through the application of what they have learned, that they've actually seen a turnaround and a business success that's come out of their own change in their style of leadership? Because I know for me, much of my career in corporate life was during the age of command and control leadership, and do as I say because I say it, and very little servant leadership, which I know is is what you propose, you know, in changing the heart of the leader.
Well, certainly Jesus epitomized servant leadership. And since we've just gone through and we're in now the Easter season, but through Easter Sunday, a lot of churches practice the servant leadership of washing of the feet. I think the biggest thing that we've seen is people telling us, and this is actually my own response to this program within the first year and even continuing, and that is I thought I knew what being a Christian was all about, and I'm really just beginning to understand it.
Isn't it funny how that happens?
Well, it is funny, and the way I relate to it is I had the handshake down and some of the lingo, but boy, now I'm learning, and it's called surrender, surrendering your life to a higher authority and being guided by principles that are all there all the time for anybody who wants them. And that's the other great thing about this program. Although it would seem like this, you know, this program is fairly sophisticated in the way we've developed the curriculum, you know, really, anybody could pick up the Bible, and they can see in that Bible as they read it that there is a leadership program there, and they can access the power that gives anybody the opportunity to make the correct decisions. As far as success stories, I think is rather interesting. Our first year graduates was in May of 2008, and here we are into the second class, and the entire nation and the world is experiencing tremendous upheaval.
Right.
In the economies. And I think that what we're seeing probably more than anything else is people, when they attend class, sharing with us that they're going through a very difficult times downsizing their companies. And we're seeing people respond to this class by saying that these difficult decisions that they have to make now certainly are being made with a much better understanding of how God really wants to be involved as the CEO of your business.
Right.
So most of the stories now are just how people are surviving. And so
Right. We're
hearing that LifeWork leadership, at least in the Tampa Bay area, for the people involved, is truly a godsend.
And, Ken, is it the intention that those who graduate, participate moving forward in mentoring those who are going through? Is there a role for those individuals, or do they go through and just go on about their business?
Well, they do mentor, and we invite all of our graduates to come back for classes, and some of them will actually come and facilitate table discussions. Our class is set up in usually rounds of eight, because there's a great deal of discussion at a table. We throw things out to the group after a point has been presented, and we ask them to discuss it. And so we have graduates who will come back and be the facilitators. They will also get people together and have their own meetings in between and share stories and expertise and things like that. So an awful lot of that is going on. And as it grows, there's going to be, and as there is in Orlando, 600 to 800 people regularly getting together for events that are designed to support the community. I think that's the other thing that's special about this program. The goal of the program is individual transformation, but then to reach out to the community from this individual transformation. And that happens. We have what we call circles, where we take and we ask a class member to say, okay, we've just completed the class. What is it that you now know as a result of this class? And then how will you apply what you know, first and foremost, to your family situation? Then how will you apply it with your church and then your business and the community? Ultimately, what we want to do is to see God's movement across our community, a transformation to a truly a godly, blessed community. But we don't do it directly. We do it through the leaders who come through the program. And especially with churches and nonprofits, our goal is to have them move out into the community a much more dedicated and educated and committed a member of a board, a member of a church leadership deacon program or whatever, and certainly on the nonprofit organizations in the community, people who, when they're working in the community, know exactly why they're doing it, who they're doing it for, and how to do it.
Right. Well, I was just reading Ed Koble's quote that's in your brochure, and he said, LifeWork leadership is a refreshing model of Christian leadership development that has the potential to promote both revival and reformation in our community. And it's funny to look at that word reformation because, it, you know, I mean, it's had a lot of meaning through the ages. But right now, I actually look at it differently as reformation. Because here in Tampa in particular, and one of the ways that I actually came across your organization was through an organization called Real Estate Lives. And on Thursday, in my Faith in the Marketplace segment, I'm going to be interviewing Ron from Real Estate Lives. And, you know, this community has been impacted severely by two different industries that are very large here. One is everything surrounding real estate, both commercial and residential, because we depend so much on, you know, people coming into the area and buying, you know, second homes and buying homes for rental, as well as the travel industry. And that has been my background for the last 30 years. And we really need a reformation in every sense of the word here in our community. And, you know, I don't think that anybody would argue that we also need revival. So I'm just really happy to see that men of stature and men that have built successful companies recognize that model of leadership and really transforming the way that they lead is critical in that success and in revitalizing our communities, and that these leaders actually can use that influence to make a lasting difference in the community. So talk to me a little bit about legacy, because legacy is really what this show has as its focus, you know, leaving behind not just a list of companies that you worked for or a list of homes that you owned over the years or, you know, what boats or cars that you've amassed, but really having a way that people will be able to look back on our lives and see what we touched.
Well, we certainly don't subscribe to saying that he who dies with the most toys wins.
Right.
We look at legacy, and actually we encourage people to look at the 10,000-year plan. 10,000 years from now, what is it that you are going to be remembered for? What's going to be important? In fact, sometimes ask the question, what did you do today that was significant? And then you ask the question, well, what's significant? And then
Right. The
final answer is anything that is eternal.
Right.
So what we're looking for with this program and each of the people that are, you know, in the classes is to say, what is it 10,000 years from now that's really important? What kind of a legacy do you want to leave? And that's, again, what this, you know, the final class is about. And that's usually related to souls. The people that you come into contact with in your businesses, in your church, are people who will be there in eternity as their souls exist. And so what did you do today to make life better? Did you possibly treat somebody a little bit better? Did you not snap, you know, at home, at one of your family members, a wife, a husband, a child? But ask people to constantly think as they make decisions as to how to respond to things. How's this going to affect this person's life? And just, you know, again, the man in the mirror, the woman in the mirror, what kind of a legacy? If they have to write you your obituary, if you wrote it, what would you like people to remember you for? And it's usually not the houses. It's not
Right. The
cars. It's what did you mean? What kind of a meaningful effect did you have on people's lives? And I would say that when people finish the program, they understand and much more committed. What their calling is, and that calling truly is to live the godly life and to make decisions in leadership that bring other people towards the same kind of commitment and towards eternal life.
Right, and as I'm reading the various values that you talk about and what a participant in LifeWork leadership can gain, the first one is actually the one that hits me the hardest, which is, you know, a clear perspective and purpose of who they are and how they fit into their world, which is this whole the whole concept of purpose and significance when you're looking at that very, very long-term perspective, as you have described, the 10,000-year horizon versus, you know, we typically think in our own limited mindsets of long-term planning being 3 to 5 years. So I think that helping people understand, you know, who they are in that eternal context has got to be world-jarring for some of these men and women who come into the program.
Well, it is. Of course, it really starts out with focusing on, again, who's really in control. And worldview is really critical. You know, it's interesting. If you ask people what their worldview is, the majority of the people really don't have a defined understanding of what a worldview is. It's almost a cafeteria style, well, I believe this or I believe that. And the Christian worldview is relatively simple, and that is God did create the world, that there is the triune God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and that there is a plan. He's created us for a purpose, and are you living out that purpose? And
right.
It is amazing how people are making decisions based on a worldview that they've never really completely set down and thought about. They allow their worldview to include such things as evolution,
right.
Or that there is no God, or if there is a God, he didn't do this or didn't do that. And it's really important if you're going to leave a legacy that you understand the very basis of it, and that is, why were we created?
Right.
What's our purpose? And then start fulfilling that purpose.
Exactly. Well, Ken, it was interesting. Last week I had to go over to Kennedy Space Center for a meeting. And just as I was getting ready to leave, I thought, oh, I need to download a book to my iPod so, you know, that I'll have something to listen to, because that drive on I-4 is pretty painful otherwise. And I ended up downloading C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity.
Oh.
And, oh, my gosh, you know, this book was all putting his radio broadcasts into writing. And it takes, you know, people from, you know, their very, very most basic views about life and helps them step by step through understanding the kind of worldview that you're talking about. And I don't know if you have ever read that book, but that was, I think, one of the most impactful things I have read in my entire life, and I'm looking forward to going back and actually getting the physical book so that I can, you know, because sometimes when you're hearing something, it impacts you differently than when you're reading it. But, you know, I think you're right. People have taken bits and pieces of what is convenient to believe versus, you know, unpeeling the truth, which you really can't alter what that is. I mean, you can change your belief about it, but you can't change the truth. You can't change gravity, and you can't change, you know, the theory of relativity and all of those things that we see as natural laws. And fortunately, that law also includes God's grace, and I am really, really happy about that piece. Well, Ken, it has just been a delight to interview you. I can't wait to meet you, and I'm really looking forward to the meeting on the 5th, and I am praying for God's blessing on our business so that I can actually be a part of the program in the fall.
Well, I'll pray for the same, and if your listeners are interested in joining us, if they want to contact us, they can go to the website, lifeworkleadership.org, and then from that, check with the Tampa Bay location. And they'll have our email address, and they can get in touch with us, or they can get in touch with us through your website.
Great. And Ken, if someone is listening from some other part of the country that has been intrigued by this concept of really this reformation and revival in their own cities based on adopting this program, who should they contact within LifeWork Leadership to find out about forming the same kind of organization in their city?
Well, again, if they go to the lifeworkleadership.org website, they will be able to see that there is a national connection there right on the front page. And there's phone number and email address. Steve French is the president of LifeWork Leadership National, and he would be more than happy to discuss it with people. It's a relatively simple thing. the Lord just has to put it on your heart, and
right.
if it's God's plan, He'll make sure that you have all the resources necessary to get a program started.
Absolutely. Well, Ken, I thank you for your perspective, and thank you for taking the time this morning to participate. It's been a delight.
Thank you, and God blessing on your business as well.
Thank you so much. Okay, take care.
Thanks.
All right. We are, again, I always say we're going to shift gears, but, you know, growth, which is our next topic, it really builds on the two previous topics where we began with talking about innovation with our guest, Les Otterlenghi, and I've had the pleasure of watching his career and the various companies that he has formed over the years, you know, build from a seed of innovation. And then, as Ken discussed, the whole perspective on leadership of servant leadership rather than that old command and control style of leadership that many of us grew up under and what that can do to individuals, to companies, and even to full communities. And now I am going to welcome our next guest. And Stacy, you told me how to pronounce your last name. Is it Hunky?
You got it. Good morning, Tiki.
Good. Well, I see you're from the Midwest. You're calling in from Chicago?
I am calling from in beautiful Windy City, Chicago, you bet.
Okay, great. Well, that name sounds like something I would have heard in Milwaukee, which is where I grew up. So I actually had a friend named Hanky, which is how your name looks like it should be pronounced. So
yes.
Thank you for correcting me.
You're welcome.
Well, I am delighted. I mean, this particular call is by divine appointment because yesterday I was I had a spot open on my show today, and if you look back over the history of the shows that we've done, all three of our first morning shows and even the last one, which is about being a corporate escape artist, always hang together so beautifully, as if they were knit together, and I would love to take credit for that. But I was just delighted when you called me yesterday following up on some previous correspondence we had, because you actually are the perfect segue from talking about innovation and leadership with a heart-centered focus into talking about growth and really setting out to do anything it is that you want to do. And as I understand it, and I haven't had the pleasure of reading your book yet, but I look forward to doing that, you have focused on how to help people actually get the job done of what it is they need to do to build their companies. So why don't we start by you just telling me a little bit about you and your background and what led you to write books?
Yeah, my background is in communication. So I actually, Tiki, started off in radio and voiceover work in commercials and then just decided there's got to be something that I can really give back. And it started with doing a lot of research around what were the biggest gaps in individuals' development. And time again, it came down to the inability to effectively communicate. And I know that sounds very elementary, but when we talk about not being able to effectively communicate, it's, are we really as influential as we can be? Do we have as much impact on not only what we say, but how people respond to us? And the book was really started, the mindset was there about 2 years ago as I traveled nationwide, worldwide, working with a variety of different individuals within corporations. I was finding that it's not so much about what you say, but it's even bigger than that. It's making sure that what you say matches how you say it, whether that's over the phone like we are today or it's in person, anytime individuals communicate. Because I find that we don't know what we don't know. And we walk around with this mystery of not really knowing what other people see and hear when we communicate. And some of our listeners might right now might be thinking, well, when I know what to say, I'm confident. That's when I feel comfortable. And my response to that is just because you feel confident, just because you feel comfortable, doesn't mean that's the perception your listeners are creating of you. And that's where I come in and say, let's take a really close look to give you an increase in your awareness on really how your message is coming across and what kind of perceptions individuals create of you. Because let's face it, you know, we buy people, right? We've heard that for years and years.
that if someone really, as you're having this interaction with them, if they think, gosh, here's someone I can trust, here's someone that I can believe, they are more likely to follow, they are more likely to have confidence in you and therefore take the action you want them to take. And at the end of the day, no matter what business we're in, it's all about the bottom line and how productive we are and the results that we can create throughout the day.
Well, your book, the subtitle on your book intrigues me because the title of the book is Yes, You Can, and it says everything you need from A to Z to influence others to take action.
Mm-hmm.
So I can only surmise that your book goes through kind of an orderly beginning of the alphabet to the end of the alphabet list of things that you can do to actually go for it and to get things done because, as you have mentioned, influencing others and the approach that you take has more to do with how you say it and how you feel it than what you say, right?
Yeah, and it's the idea of, not that I'm saying the words are not important, my goal when I work with someone and the goal of writing that book is to really give people practical, immediate tools that they can use not only professionally but personally as well, because we're talking about communication every walk of life, personally and professionally. And I always tease and have fun with my participants that I work with, and I say to them, you cannot be confident Monday through Friday and then let Saturday and Sunday go. How can you change these behaviors throughout your life? And the idea of the book, A to Z, the book was really written so that you don't have to read from cover to cover in one sitting and then get it accomplished. It's really designed as based on what's going on in your life. Maybe there's a big presentation you're preparing for. Maybe it's something about a relationship in your personal life that you have to have these conversations and you're trying to figure out, how can I motivate this person to just understand the direction I'm coming from? That you can read that book, pick it up wherever you need to pick it up within that alphabet, and you could read one chapter and still walk away and say, Got it. I know what I need to do to build on what already works for me, my strengths, and I know what I need to do if this is a weak area for me so that I can balance out my weaknesses.
Well, I love that. And anytime a tool is practical, and in particular a book, because it's so rare these days for me to have the time to sit down and read something all in one sitting. That's why audiobooks have such great appeal to me, the rare times when I'm in the car for a couple of hours, being able to listen to that. Tell me a little bit about your consulting firm, because you have mentioned that you help companies figure this out. Do you work with both companies and with individuals?
We do. We do a combination of both, where we'll have individuals that will approach us, and depending, again, what's going on in their life, whether they're just in a position where they're running a business, and so much of their business is about building the relationships they already have with their clients, expanding that customer base, and they want to build more relationships and maintain those, we'll work with them on that level. Or it might be someone who tends to be very visible, whether it's of their organization, their association, or their company, and because they're so visible, they present messages often in front of large groups, whether it's their teams or outside their company as a representative of their company. And then in addition, we go into companies and we do small workshops. They're usually 2 days in length. And the return on investment for our clients is we do a lot of videotaping. So when people ask me, Chickie, well, kind of explain to me, what do? I compare it to a golf coach, a tennis coach, where if any of our listeners can relate to, if you ever went for a golf lesson perhaps, the golf coach would probably ask you, first thing, show me how you swing the club. And some of the golf coaches or even tennis lessons that are out there, they will videotape you. That way you can see for yourself, where is your form not where it needs to be? What's causing that ball to go way off to the right? We do it very similar to that, where we let people show us first how they communicate, whether it's a face-to-face conversation or maybe it's more of a presentation format, and then we show them on the playback of that video to say, take a look, what do you see? And that is some
powerful stuff, because it's probably the biggest investment to do something like videotaping. You really get a strong, truthful perspective of what your listeners are seeing when
right.
you're interacting with them. And that's where, Tiki, a lot of people will say, wow, I had no idea. Whether that's good or an area they want to improve in, or we hear a lot of comments as to, well, that would explain.
Right. You know, it's so funny different. Because the first time I ever got videotaped, and it was in a training class back in American Airlines Sabre, and I remember sitting and watching the video thinking that I looked like someone that I knew. And what I was seeing were the mannerisms of people I had come across in my life that I had taken on. Some of it was my mother or my sister or my father or a friend, and it was a movement or a gesture. But it is so bizarre, you know, to go through that for the first time. And I can even tell you that back in January, before Solutions Live was even an inkling in my life, I was invited to be on Blog Talk Radio on a show called Twitter Tuesdays. And I actually did it in the parking lot of the Omni Hotel in Orlando, because I was over there for a meeting.
Yes.
And it was blistering hot, even in January, sitting in the car because I didn't want to have the air conditioning on. And when I got home, I listened to the show, and I told my husband, I said, oh, my gosh, I sound so nasal. And, and you know, not 10 days later, I knew that I had to start this show, and I have since done 78 radio shows. So
wow.
that first impression, even of yourself, I mean, I think we think of that first impression as what other people think of us. But it's
right.
even more important for our confidence factor for us to be comfortable with the first impression of ourselves. So I love the approach
yes.
that you're taking in your consulting. So tell me a little bit more about the practical and immediate skills and techniques that I can get through reading your book. Does the book give me examples of, like, the things not to do, or does it focus on primarily the things that you should do?
Yeah, the book was fun to write in that, because of all the interaction I've had with so many wonderful people in my life and different organizations, I use a lot of stories, without using names, of course, I use a lot of stories of individuals that have attended the class, kind of the before and the after.
Right.
And people get a kick out of the story, because even as I present at conferences, I'll demonstrate some of the things that I see people do, and it just cracks people up because I think they can relate. So the practical piece, we start with the book talking a lot about the how you say it. What does, just how you enter the room, do you walk in that room like you belong there? And once you're in that room, do you hang on to that respect? Do you earn that respect to stay in that room and for people to actually want to listen to you? And a lot of that is just how you enter. It's things like your posture, which is sometimes elementary because people don't think about it, how you stand, how you sit. We talk about when you are speaking, whether it's to one individual or to more than two individuals, what does your eye contact communicate? Where are you looking? And then the one I think our listeners can all relate to, particularly if you've got someone that is delivering a presentation with PowerPoint or they're working off of notes very heavily,
right.
how many times do we see individuals, they have conversations with stuff. They have conversations with the slide, conversations with their laptop, their notes, and you start wondering, well, who are you talking to? Well, you're starting to create a relationship with
that
object.
I resemble that remark. I remember presentations where I've done exactly that.
Yeah, and everyone laughs at it because we're all, and I'm just to blame, I'm guilty of it before I knew really what's the secret of connecting and engaging all the time. And it's how you work your eyes. It's things like your gestures. How many times do you hear people say, well, I clench my fist, or I fidget with my fingers because I don't know what else to do with it. Or I've been told I talk with my hands. Well, then they go over the top and they do nothing at all. We start in the book and even our workshops really showing individuals how to use these nonverbal behaviors. Then they get to see it on tape and they realize, whoa, even though it feels uncomfortable because it's something I'm not used to doing, it's not my day-to-day habit, it looks effective. And in the book, we verbally write it out and talk about these things on, gosh, how can you start using it? I think the big one, which I'm sure you can relate to, Chickie, with the many people that you interact with,
is these noises that we make when we talk. And when I talk about noises, I'm referring to the ahs, ums, and so, but, like,
right.
And the list goes on and on. And that probably
How do you get people to suppress those things? Because you're right, the more you become aware of something you've done, you know, the more it plagues you, I think, in most people's
right.
lives.
It does, and that's the challenge that they go through our courses when we start giving them interactive feedback, constructive feedback, and we make them aware every time they use what we refer to as non-words. They get so thrown off that they start feeling like, well, I'm thinking so much about what I'm going to say about not using the non-word, or I'm supposed to pause instead, that now I can't even think of what I want to say, right? And it's just because it's something new. And the idea is, how do we stop them from saying it? Is first, we need to make them aware of it. And that is obviously the help of the video camera, but just pointing out to someone when they use one of those words. And the idea is, well, how do you recover from it? It's giving yourself that permission, instead of using a non-word to buy yourself time and think about what you want to say, pause instead. And it's such a tough thing, because people feel as though when they pause, silence is eternity. Versus that's, again, one of those things where, yeah, it might feel like silence to you. For your listeners, though, it's so powerful, because it gives your listener a chance to hear and understand what you're saying.
Right, and actually that has been one of the keys of learning how to have a successful radio show, because normally I have a co-host on Tuesday mornings, Chris Bradshaw, but she wasn't able to be here today.
Uh-huh.
And if I don't pause, and if I can't get my guest to pause, she never gets a chance to pop in. And she has such amazing, insightful questions and observations that I feel robbed if I haven't given her that opportunity.
Sure.
And we like to do our show largely unscripted. You know, sometimes we do have questions, you know, that we want to make sure that we get through with our guests. But I certainly prefer to do it unscripted. And again, you're right, from a listener's perspective, you know, not having a monologue and not having there I go. Now, see, I haven't done that the whole show, and now you made me think of it.
Exactly,
anyway.
And I'm throwing you off, right?
Yeah, and so I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to let you talk.
We do. It's rather interesting. I think individuals will say to me, well, if I pause, people are going to interrupt me. And I really, really believe that the reason people interrupt each other, it's because as the speaker, you take too long to get to the point, and people get frustrated. Especially, I'm visualizing a boardroom right now, and you need to make best use of that meeting, get some actions that come and results out of that meeting. And I get a lot of women in particular, you know, I get it more from women that'll say, teach me how not to get interrupted. Teach me how to be heard at that boardroom table or whatever situation it may be. And the first thing that I teach them is, first, A, clarity. Speak to be heard. Speak up. And speak with confidence, and a lot of that comes through your volume and your inflection. And then speak in very short, concise sentences, eliminating these non-words that really create run-ons in what you say. And you start confusing your listener rather than intriguing them and creating and grabbing attention for them to want to listen to what you have to say. And as you can imagine, it's tough. You know, I have two little nieces, 4 and 6 years old, and they are using a lot of the non-words. And when I say to my sister, their mother, I had asked them the first time I heard them really use a lot of these non-words, I had said to my sister, who taught them this? Well, Tiki, my entire family in unison said, Stacy, hands off the children. But my point is, gosh, if they're learning to speak this way at a very young age, no wonder we reach adulthood and we don't even know we use them.
Right.
And that's where, you know, a tip for our listeners today, anyone that's listening, is listen to your voicemail messages, the voicemail message that you leave for your callers, and re-record those every day until you approve of it. Or audio tape yourself, just randomly through the day, audio tape yourself, because that way you'll get a temperature check on not only the non-words that you're using, also how you sound. Does your voice sound confident to you? And if not,
It may be simple tricks as sitting up straight, standing up straight when you speak, using your diaphragm rather than speaking from your upper chest, which most people do.
Huh. Well, that's very, very interesting and very practical. And I do want to mention for our listeners that if you do have a question for Stacy, that you can go to the blogtalkradio.com/solutionslive page. And there is a chat room that you can open. It's on the center of the page. And you can just type in your questions, and I'll pass them on to Stacy.
Right.
Or you can also call in at 646-727-2840. And I also do want to stop just for a second and thank our sponsor for today, the Executive Girlfriends Group. It is a by-invitation-only group for executive women. And we have a weekly call every week, giving the women the opportunity not only to connect throughout the week through our electronic platform, but also to form relationships. And so if there is any interest in forming an executive girlfriends group in your industry, we currently have a focus on the travel industry, please send an email to egg@solutionswithaz.com. And, Stacy, I'm hoping I can get you to talk to the Executive Girlfriends Group because, as you just mentioned, women have some unique challenges in the business world about communicating effectively. And I know that the women of the Executive Girlfriends Group that I host now for the travel industry have a very high level of interest in being taken more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, and I would be honored to. And there's definitely challenges the way women communicate versus the way men communicate. And I think one thing in particular is women tend to use a lot of excuses in some of the words that they put together. And
give
it will
an
be
example.
Things like, well, what I meant to say. And I'll say to women, just say it. Because now you've already lost some of that credibility. Because that's an example of it took a little too long to get to the point. Or I hear a lot of, to be honest with you.
Mm.
Well, what's been happening this entire time?
Right, have you not been being honest?
Right, so there's definitely words that we tend to use. Then for men, one that I hear very frequently, and it occurs more when, not that it doesn't happen in females, I just tend to hear it more in men, when they handle question and answers. Or they handle objections, they tend to use the word but and the word however frequently in their answer. And what happens if we use but, however, in the middle of our answer, what the words that have some negative connotation to them, they communicate, you are wrong and I am right. They don't communicate, well, perhaps you didn't hear me correctly, but it's rather, you are wrong and I am right. And suddenly, whatever they said before they used the word but in their answer, that piece is lost. And that's usually more of the softer approach or the positive approach to their answer. It's just being aware, more conscious of not only the words we use, how do we position them together, how do we deliver them. And that's where I go back to the power of the pause. The pausing, when we do pause, it is to give you, the speaker, an opportunity to think on your feet and to breathe.
Right.
And when individuals call me and say, oh, you know, I'm panicking or I don't want to do this, I really need some advice, the first thing I will say to them is take a breath because breathing will help you relax. And it sounds a little common sense, yet when we don't pause, we're taking such quick breaths that we run out of air. It impacts the sound of our voice, how loud we are, because voice is definitely a confidence skill. And then we start to get uncomfortable and nervous. I saw a quote, and it was an unknown author. I just ran across a quote the other day, and it was talking about fear and how much fear can really take over our ability to influence and our impact. And it stated that don't fear your own fear. Rather, use it to propel yourself forward, and it may become the best motivator you can find.
Huh.
Pretty powerful stuff.
I hadn't thought about that, but, you know, it's really true because, in particular, those things that you were talking about that women do in communication, I know quite often we have already prejudged our audience that they are not going to accept what we say.
Yes.
And so those qualifiers are used frequently in conversation. And there is a person in my life, and I won't say who it is, although she doesn't generally listen to Blog Talk Radio, so I don't have any fears there. But this individual is from a generation that is quite older. And everything she says, she qualifies before she says it. And whether it's, I don't know what you want for supper, or I don't know this, or I don't know that, you know, I talk to her about that all the time, saying, no, you need to just say it. You know, say,
right.
What is it that you want? Not admitting your own fault. And again, the fear in that particular situation is that she's not going to make the choice that I would have liked. So she has to indicate that she knows that she doesn't know what I'd like. And I mean, it's a crazy way of communicating, but it is something that, again, if we have heard it from people around us, I can see why it gets adopted.
Right. And I think you had stated it clearly. We tried to qualify. We try to give reasoning for why we're about to say something. You made an important comment that as females, we tend to predict our listener that they are not going to want to listen to us, or they're not going to be in agreement to what I say. Well, that's actually a benefit. Now, if you could take that mindset, take it to the next step and say, all right, I'm walking into this group. They're going to be challenging. I think they're going to challenge my recommendations. I might really need to work hard to persuade them. Well, then prepare that message accordingly.
Yes.
You know, use that as a bonus where you should set your opening. You know, the first thing that you say should really be to address some of these issues that they have so that they can understand, hey, you know where they're coming from.
Exactly.
And that's a whole other topic. You know, how many times do we design a message because it's for us rather than what our listeners really want to hear?
Exactly. Well, we focused a lot about what the women do wrong. What about the men?
I think
there
men,
anything gender
and I wonder
related?
If it's sometimes competition. I know there's competition among females as well. But I think men are where they use these negative words like but and however. They tend to be a little bit more aggressive in their communication, where they tend to give us more than we need to know sometimes. Because it's more of, well, I want to show you how smart and how knowledgeable I am. Again, I'm not saying that women don't do it. I just tend to see it more in men than I do in women.
Right, and I know you do, because you catch it on tape, you do get to see a lot of that. And again, I didn't want to so much focus on the gender issues, but fair is fair, and we were talking about the foibles that women
right.
have. And
if everyone was such great communicators, or if it was so easy, the world would be perfect. And I think with communication and really improving those skills, it's like any athlete who's out there, a professional athlete, they don't practice once and then they're cured for life and they're going to play this great game every day. No, I mean, they understand that this is a process and that practice is so key. The difference, though, for us in the corporate world, every day for us is game day.
Right.
Yet you can practice. It's just thinking about every interaction that you have or any interaction, communication situation that our listeners have this afternoon, just even taking 5 minutes and paying attention to what you're saying, how you're saying it, can be the first step to making a change that can help change the way you communicate forever.
Mm. Well, you have given us some really, really practical tips. Can you tell folks how to reach you and how to learn more about both your consulting and coaching and also about your book?
The book, Yes, You Can, Everything You Need from A to Z to Influence Others to Take Action, it can be found on the website, which is www.myname, which is spelled STACEYHANKE.com. And all the information is on that website, along with the book, as well as my contact information in person.
Okay, terrific. And I've also got the link to your book on the Solutions site.
Thank you.
so those who have the Solutions Live link will be able to go to that, and we'll give that at the end of the show. Well, Stacy, I am just so happy that you were able to turn on a dime and be on today's show, and you and I can regroup later to talk about the Executive Girlfriends Group call, because I know that that audience would love to hear what you have to say about first impressions.
Well, it was a true pleasure talking to you. It was meant to be. I'm glad we connected.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Take care.
Nothing happens by accident. So you have a terrific day, and I will talk to you soon.
You as well. Take care. Bye.
Okay, great. All right. Well, we're coming into the home stretch on Solutions Live Business Edition, and we are going to get our next guest on the air, and I am joined by Pamela Skillings. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing great. And did you have a good holiday weekend?
I did. I had a chance to go home to where I grew up in Pennsylvania, and it seems, you know, I have a lot of entrepreneurs in the family, so it was nice for family reasons, and also sharing some ideas. My uncle was my example. He's an entrepreneur, and my brother is as well, so we had a lot of good talks on that subject as well.
Well, great. Well, for those who haven't listened to this show before, this show is titled Corporate Escape Artists. And the inspiration for this show was actually a book that Pamela wrote. And the book is called Escape from Corporate America. And Pamela is not only a corporate escape artist herself, but she has written the stories of a number of individuals. And over the course of the last few weeks, we have been showcasing some of the folks that have been in her book and some people that she knew who had the courage to follow their dream and to prepare properly, not necessarily to just jump right out of the corporate boat into their own venture. But we're going to talk today a little bit about what happens when you make the decision that you actually want to do this, because Pamela and I have both left corporate jobs. I mean, mine was actually quite a long time ago. I left in 1995 and had a first hop out of my own corporate career, which had been in the travel industry working for very large companies providing technology that allows buyers to marry the sellers, both in travel agencies and in online travel. And I ended up forming my own consulting firm back in 1996 and went first to a small technology venture run by some friends of mine and, you know, thought this was going to be my golden goose. I had stock in the company and, you know, 60 days later, no money for payroll. So I know that we are not the only firm that has those kind of stories, or that I'm not the only person who has those kinds of stories. But I then went on to have a 13-year career in consulting, and in the midst of that, actually at the tail end of that, launched a new technology company 2.5 years ago. And as I mentioned in my show with Les Ottolenghi about innovation, we were very much ahead of the curve, had some things that needed to be hammered out in the business model, and the company at its first blush into the marketplace didn't succeed. But I'm fortunate that we have the technology sitting on the shelf and that we still own the asset and can take it the next step, learning from all of the mistakes that we've made. So I've kind of been all around this, Pamela, and started this new venture just a little bit less than 3 months ago. It's gone by so quickly. But let's shift gears back to talking about that big transition from corporate to entrepreneur. And what are those things that you and I both wish somebody had told us?
Yes, absolutely. And I love that you shared a little bit more of your story, because I was realizing this morning that I don't think I ever had a chance to interview you on the program about your escape.
Well, we'll do that another day.
we'll
do it a little bit today.
Yeah, we'll get you to share some of your insights today. But, yeah, absolutely. I think, and that was a big reason why I decided to write the book, was because of the things that I discovered during the transition that I hadn't thought of before as someone who'd never started a business, who'd been in the corporate world for so long. So I really wanted to share not only the inspiration, but also some of the advice and things that people could prepare for before they made the leap. And I think in this environment, it's interesting, I'm doing a lot of speaking lately, and I'm talking to a lot of people, and they seem to fall into either two camps. They're either people who've been laid off and are thinking of starting something now, or there are people who are still kind of feel stuck in a job but want to sort of start something on the side. They're not ready to jump in this market, but they want to kind of get start laying the groundwork for their business. So those are the situations that I'm seeing and where I'm trying to give people advice. And one of the things that I tell people is that it really is possible to do this a little bit at a time, to do this on the side if you need to. It's not all or nothing, depending on your business model. But in most cases, you can keep your job until you get things up and running, or some people choose to take what I call in the book a stepping stone job, or perhaps a consulting arrangement, so that they have some cash flow coming in during those early days of starting their business. So,
well, you know, you mentioned consulting, Pamela, and it's interesting because I know we all know a large number of people, unfortunately, that are currently out of work. And whether they lost their jobs or in my case, we had a number of people working for us in our previous venture that we furloughed over a year ago and have not been able to rehire them, and I will say yet, because there still is some hope there. But I see a lot of people looking at consulting as kind of their way out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you and I have both found out that consulting isn't something that you take on lightly. And while you may be a technical expert at something, being able to actually turn it into a business is something completely different.
Yeah, that's the thing that people don't take into account is not only, you know, it's one thing to be great at what you do and to have skills and talents that are marketable, but then you also have to run the business, make sure the invoices go out, make sure you're developing a pipeline of new business, all of those things that are outside of your perhaps your area of expertise. So that's one thing I do try to warn people about when they're thinking about consulting. It can be very attractive because you can start it with very little investment or overhead, but that doesn't mean it's not a serious business that you should actually have a business plan for and think through before you pursue it.
Right, right. And you bring up some really good points of being able to keep the pipeline full, having somebody to do the administrative work. And I know when I first started my consulting firm back in 1996, pretty much I was able to manage it because it was I would have one project going, maybe somebody would come to me for another project, and I wasn't quite done with the other one.
Yeah.
But I'd go ahead and take it on because I never knew when the next one was coming, you know, which
right.
is that horrible phase that you're in when you first hang out your shingle. And
yeah.
whether you do it by forming a company or you do it, you know, while you're looking for a job and you just take on project work, it really starts getting difficult actually when you succeed, right?
Yes.
because when
yeah.
you succeed, the business starts coming in faster and faster, and you have to decide whether to say no or yes. And sometimes saying yes means that you have to entrust work to others.
Yes.
And if we take a look at the biggest mistakes that we have each made in our personal situations, I know for me, I looked at people who had been technical experts in corporate life or who had been really powerful in a boardroom situation.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were available, I took them in to a consulting project. And I pretty quickly found out that while a lot of people can be good in a meeting, actually documenting it and writing it up in a way that a customer will value enough to spend several hundred thousand on a project or several thousand dollars, you know, a day on a project, that's a completely different thing.
Absolutely. And a lot of those people are not conditioned to sell themselves and to manage clients because they're so used to operating in that corporate bureaucratic environment where they do what they're told and everyone knows what they do and why they do it. And it's a whole different way of operating.
Right.
And I think one of the things that you say, you know, careful what you wish for, and I definitely hit that point with my business. When I started my consulting business and, you know, working like crazy to get it off the ground and get the client work coming in, and then reaching that point where I just didn't have the hours in the day to do it all. And then
right.
you have to start making choices about letting go of perhaps some of your lower paying clients or some of the projects that don't fit into your sweet spot. You know, at the beginning you may take in some side projects that, you know, you can do, but they aren't really what you like to do best. And so figuring out how to take that business to the next level while still being afraid of, you know, I know for me at the time I thought, well, if I let go of these clients, if I say no, what if everything else dries up and I never get another client again?
Right, right.
You know, so letting go of some of those fears and being smart about it, not burning bridges, but understanding that to move forward and to grow, you have to evolve.
Well, and I think that that's really important, Pamela, when you take a look at crafting who the perfect client is. And I know that in the early stages of a business, people don't have the luxury, if you will, to say who the perfect client is. But if you haven't gone through that exercise, and for me, it actually just happened about a year ago where I took a look at what I had been doing since 1996 in my consulting firm. And actually 2 years ago, my husband and I sold our office building and made the decision to move home. And, you know, we're fortunate enough to have a house that's large enough for he and I both to have separate offices. And in doing that, I started cleaning out my files. And I'll never forget sitting on the floor, actually in my assistant's office, going through the files and looking at the deliverables for various projects I had done and saying, oh, never want to do that again, you know, and chunking it. And, oh, you know that we really did a good job on that one. But, boy, if somebody comes to me for that, I don't want to do it. But, you know, I didn't act on that 2 years ago. And it wasn't until about a year ago that I looked at my website and realized that I still had a lot of things listed on my website that I did and that I could do and that I could find people to do. And they weren't things that I wanted to do. So I had to purge that list of services and products to come down to what really gave me, and I'm going to use the word pleasure because I think that that's really important. And, you know, do what you love and the money will follow is a book that I remember my husband and I reading right after we were first married because I was still in a corporate job and he was trying to figure out what he wanted to do. And I wonder whatever happened to the author of that book. I'm going to have to see if they're still around and interview them and see if they're doing what they love and if the money did in fact follow. And, you know, this venture that we're doing right now in the radio show is something that I am absolutely loving and, you know, hoping and believing that the money will follow. And I've met so many interesting people. But, you know, again, I want to get back to that point that you made, that sometimes you look at clients and maybe you do get rid of the ones that are unprofitable or you get rid of the ones where you're doing work that, you know, while you can do it, you really shouldn't be doing it. So that really was one of my big aha moments in my own business. So what about for you, Pamela? What has been the biggest aha moment for you about what you perhaps even were preaching in your book or telling the stories but maybe weren't doing yourself?
Yeah, and I think it ties into what you just were speaking about and that ability of being able to evolve and also to let go and to not try to be all things to all clients. Because that was part of my strategy was to start out basically by taking on whatever work I could get. You know, I needed to pay my bills. And I cataloged my talents and my abilities. And, you know, there were some, you know, basic copywriting projects that weren't particularly difficult that I essentially could have done in my sleep. And, you know, taking on those projects at the beginning was great for me because it got me started in the consulting world, introduced me to some great clients who went on to hire me for more strategic projects and ongoing assignments. But there got to be a point where I was just not learning to say no and also not learning to delegate, trying to control everything and keep everything going. And I burned myself out. And, you know, I will say it was a very different burnout than my corporate burnout was because I was still doing things that I love for the most part and I had control of my own business and, you know, that made up for a lot. But I did realize at a certain point that trying to be all things to all people, first of all, was burning me out and secondly was, you know, not getting me what I wanted either because you can't be everything. You have to focus on, especially for new business, selling what you want to provide and showing, you know, your specific differentiators, not trying to say, I can do that. I can do anything.
Right. I've been there. Well, you know, it's interesting, Pamela, because you talk about your burnout. Mine actually came 3 years ago, kind of at the magic 10-year mark in my business. And My husband and I are in business together, and I'm very, very blessed because he does all of the administrative side for all of our companies. We have multiple companies that we have started. But I got to that place where I remember getting off of a plane in Tampa and walking up the jet bridge and feeling like I was climbing Mount Everest. I was literally bone tired. I was exhausted, emotionally, spiritually, physically, in every sense of the word. Now, 2 months later, I actually found out that I had chronic anemia. And there was a really good reason for me feeling bone tired, because when you don't have enough blood, of the right qualities of your blood flowing through your bones, your bones actually suffer. And that is where I believe the term bone tired comes from. But what ended up happening, I ended up having to have some surgery to get some things corrected and get back on track. And I quite literally laid on my back for 3 months recovering, because it was pretty massive surgery. And what ended up happening is I just took a lot of stock of where I was in my life, and I was getting ready to turn 50, and it had a really good life, a really good run of it. And in fact, the previous year we had done 40 projects for 25 clients in the travel industry, and top name companies, blue chip all the way. And what I realized is what I had built over the previous 10 years was something I couldn't ever sell. Because it was me, and I, in many ways, was held captive by my own creation, right? Yeah. You know, when you're in a corporate life, you can look around and you can see the folks who are holding you captive, and you can look at HR and their policies and, so-and-so getting a bigger raise than I do and all the things that end up eating at you. But when it's your own company, you only get to look in the mirror and see what's wrong. And that's why when we get back to what Ken and I were talking about on the leadership show at 10:30, is really having that perspective on the legacy that you're leaving behind, and how you're behaving as a leader is so important. And we've talked about a couple of different kinds of companies on this show over the last couple of months. We've talked about service companies like my business and your business, where pretty much with almost no capital. You have to have enough money to live off of until the business starts making money. But pretty much without capital that needs to be raised, you can start a business, you can go out on your own. And if you have a good reputation or a good network, it's pretty easy to build a business where you're providing a service. Now, when you decide to build or manufacture a product or a technology, it's a whole different picture. And so this is really what the last 3 years of my life have been focused on, of raising capital. We raised nearly $7 million. And, and while that might sound like a lot, we needed 10 to achieve our goals. And so we ended up painfully 45 days after launching our product on Travelocity, having to shut the company down and let, 18 or 19 people at the time. And so that's a whole different kind of thing. So when people are still in a corporate job and have a great idea of some product that people need, how do you counsel them differently? And what have you seen in the corporate escape artist stories portrayed in your book of the difference of people who went out into a service business versus a product or manufacturing-oriented business?
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's totally different worlds. And, the advantage of the service business is that it's a much faster and easier startup, because it's basically you and your intellectual capital and your time that you're selling. And for me, that was how I started. And then, once that got going, I was able to then start, still not a product business the way a lot of product businesses are, but creating content and products that I could license and sell, like books and workshops and things like that.
Right.
But it's a whole different world when you have to go through manufacturing, when you have to pay for materials, you have to find partners to do all these things, you have to ship, you have to find distributors. It's a whole other level. The good news is that you can then make money in your sleep, which is everyone's dream. If you get it going, your products could be flying off the shelves while you're slumbering away.
My goal, and my husband and I actually said those words, and I've said many times, I set out to make money while I slept. Well, all I figured out how to do was to spend it while I slept. Because we were building a product with technology, a technology team in India. So quite literally,
right,
while I was sleeping, we were spending lots of money. And
even the hours
were
ticking by.
Absolutely. So, you know, again, our biggest revelation out of all of that wasn't that I wouldn't do it again. And I mean, although, I mean, clearly I'm not in a position to do it again, but only to revive what it was that I already built. You know, when you have a foundation of innovation, you have seen a need, and ideally one that has never been fulfilled by anyone else.
Yeah.
And again, this gets back to the first show today with Les Ottolenghi, where we were talking about innovation. And quite often, inventors and innovators come up with an idea way before the market realizes that they need it. Yeah. And sometimes the timing works out right, where you hit just perfectly and the market is ready and ready to embrace what you've got. And other times, you're still up at that bleeding edge. So can you think of any stories of folks who have hit it at exactly the right point? Because I know you've had a lot of really successful corporate escape artists that you outlined in your book.
Yeah, well, there's a couple, and remind me to come back to. I want to talk about a woman who I think is a great story. We started a one-woman manufacturing product business that's been very successful and expanded since then. But in terms of the right product at the right time, I keep coming back to Jim Koch, who started the Boston Beer Company that makes Sam Adams beer and a number of other beers. And he, you know, he just wanted to start a small brewery, make enough money to support his family. He was a management consultant previously, and it was a pretty risky move. He raised the money to start the business by getting a bunch of friends to invest a couple thousand each. And, you know, it's easy to get someone to invest in a beer company, right? They're thinking free beer for life if this thing takes off. You know, so he, you know, he had
a lot of pops if it doesn't.
Right, exactly. You know, like, you know, your bar bill at least will be covered.
Right.
But, and he just happened to get in at the right time, this whole microbrewing revolution. You know, at the time he was starting, or just before he started, it was all the big beer companies, Budweiser, and this idea of the microbrewery was still very new, and he managed to capture, come out with a great product, and he brewed the first batch in his kitchen. He was able to launch his new product right at the time that this was becoming hot, and he got selected. I think his first year got selected for prestigious, you know, Beer of the Year award. I can't remember the exact title. I'm not an expert on the beer industry, but it just completely took off from there, and then the company is huge, and he's, you know, he's obviously got a job that he loves. You know, he's traveling around to beer festivals and, you know, observing the hops and the way that the brewmasters are operating. So he's a good example of people probably told him, how are you going to compete with Budweiser and all these big beer brands that were dominating the market? And they probably told him that his idea could never take off. But of course, it absolutely did. So, I mean, he's a great example of kind of catching the wave at the right point.
Right, and you mentioned another woman who had built something that required manufacturing.
Yeah, she was really interesting. Her name is Nicole McCarthy. She started a handbag company several years ago, and she was inspired because she was working at a big financial services company. She was traveling a lot, and at the time, they didn't have all these cute laptop bags. They had these ugly, you know, functional laptop bags.
Right.
And she was running around and, you know, with a million bags hanging off of her. And she was struck by this idea to create this, you know, better laptop bag that was also fashionable. So, you know, she did it in her spare time. She started making prototypes and researching manufacturing and, you know, started selling a few on her website at a time. Her first customers were actually her coworkers, and they were very supportive. It's not every company that might be as supportive of a side business, I suppose. But in her case, she was able to do that and start selling enough that she could then, you know, start partnering with manufacturers overseas. And she kept her company for a long time just her. Everything else was outsourced or partnered. She didn't take on employees. She didn't take on financing until she had reached a certain level. And her products have now been in O Magazine and all kinds of other, you know, Daily Candy and other fashion magazines and publications. And she did it all by herself up to a certain point.
Hmm. very interesting. Well, you know, and that's really the big choice. And again, as you look at what kind of a legacy you're going to leave, and you've made the decision that you definitely don't belong in corporate America, you do have those two paths that you can go down, the business that is a service business, or the business that is a product business, or, as you mentioned, taking kind of the hybrid approach of starting in a service business and then productizing, you know, those things that allow you to begin making money while you sleep. But, you know, as you go off into that service business, and a lot of people don't think about this, the business models that you deploy really determine whether you've got something of value that someone will want to come along and buy someday. And typically when you raise money for something like a manufactured product or a technology, you're forced into talking about exit strategies. And I don't think that people who start service businesses tend to think about that so much. Pamela, what do you counsel people to do about an exit strategy when they start their own company that is pretty much reliant on themselves? Because, you know, having a retirement plan and having a way not to be working until your grave, you know, is really something that I don't think people think about when they decide to go out and do what it is that they love.
Yeah, and it's a shame because there really is no infrastructure right now for, you know, freelancers, consultants, what I call solopreneurs, you know, people who start these small businesses, often consulting businesses. And there are organizations like Freelancers Union who are sort of fighting to create some sort of infrastructure, retirement, you know, funds and healthcare programs for people who work for themselves. But it's absolutely something that you have to think about, because even if your goal is to do this for the rest of your life, and this is you're going to be your career, at some point there's going to be an exit strategy because, you know, you want to retire and move to Florida with all your friends, right? So, you know, that's definitely important. And I, you know, one of the things I tell people too is thinking about that, and having a strategy for the different phases of your business, and thinking about what you can do to create a product, to create something, even if it's intellectual property, that you could ultimately sell, license, or, you know, partner with someone who might be interested in buying you out. So looking at different strategies and models for that, and thinking about it, not being so reliant on your time and your being involved in every aspect of the business.
Oh, exactly. And one of the things that I frequently tell my friends who think that they're going to go from corporate life into forming their own firm is, don't name your company after yourself. Don't embed your own name in the company, because you're actually writing your own future by doing that. And I know that people think that, you know, coming up with clever things with their initials, you know, kind of masks that, but it really doesn't. And it's one of the reasons why I picked the name The Solutions Group, because what we did was solve problems for people. And so Solutions was perfect. And I believe that was a name that could survive my own involvement in the business should it grow, you know, to a particular place. But anyway, you know, this has been actually great fun. We probably ought to do this once a month, Pamela, just so that you and I can talk about these issues that we see, and then, you know, reserve the other three Tuesdays for having guests on, because I've really, really enjoyed this today.
Yeah, and I think we were able to dig down into some of these issues, which is hard when we've got a guest that we haven't met before that we want to hear about everything they're doing.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. It has it's been a great morning, as always. All of the shows have hung together so beautifully in telling a story about having the courage to innovate, really taking leadership much more seriously than just being the boss, and understanding the responsibility of leaving a legacy, and then hearing what Stacey had to say about growth. And then exploring some of the possibilities of what, you know, is there life after corporate America? And Pamela and I are here to tell you there is.
Absolutely.
So I just wish you a wonderful day. I hope you have more sunshine than we're having here today in Florida. It's a very gray, dreary day, and I just got an email a little while ago saying that there are tornadoes north of Tampa. So I'm going to make sure I go and turn on my TV and keep an ear out for the news.
Yeah, stay safe and stay undercover.
Absolutely. Well, Pamela, you just have a great day, and I will talk to you this week about planning for our show next.
Yep, looking forward to it. Have a great day.
All right. Take care.
For more information about Solutions Live, see www.solutionslive.blogspot.com. That's Solutions with a Z. I trust that today's show provided you with a bit of innovation and some inspiration. Join us again on Thursday from 10 until noon for the personal side of professional life. Go out and begin to leave your legacy today.